coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The Delaware Department of Correction has a new commissioner. Claire DeMatteis was officially sworn in this week.
I have had the opportunity to work with this team for the past 2 years, but I'm not a sworn law enforcement officer, so I will be surrounded by incredibly professional and experienced law enforcement officials that will balance out perhaps my strengths.
We bring you our full conversation with Claire DeMatteis. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Draft regulations governing new heavy industrial development in Delaware's coastal zone are facing pushback. We examine why. Plus, we learn more about the First State's biggest trees. Arts Playlist introduces us to an award-winning student writer. And Enlighten Me offers insight into back-to-school shopping. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Back in June, we took a look at the draft regulations created for the Coastal Zone Conversion Permit Act. The regulations, once enacted, will govern limited new industrial development in Delaware's coastal zone, specifically at 14 sites where heavy industry was already doing business in 1971 when state lawmakers passed the original Coastal Zone Act. Supporters expect opening these sites to new industrial development will spur economic development and job creation. But in the nearly 2 months since the draft regulations have been available for public review and comment, both proponents and opponents of the Coastal Zone Conversion Permit Act have found fault with them. Delaware Public Media contributor John Hurdle returns to this story this week, explaining where the issues lie in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me to explain what he found. First, just refresh our memories. How were these regulations developed over the past 2 years since the Coastal Zone Conversion Permit Act was passed?
Well, what happened was that DENREC set up something called a Regulatory Advisory Committee, and that was an 18-member panel that consisted of representatives from a variety of different interests and constituencies, business groups, environmental groups, city government, labor unions, and so on. And they spent the best part of a year coming up with a series of recommended regulations that were designed to implement the new act that will, in theory, open up these 14 sites in the coastal zone to new heavy industry. And they published these proposed regulations a couple of months ago. At that point, they were just recommendations, and DENREC had the option of accepting them or rejecting them or in whole or in part. And in fact, they ended up accepting the recommendations. And the mood music coming from the members of that committee was actually pretty positive. I mean, members of that committee were telling me that that nobody got everything that they wanted to. People were broadly satisfied that there were this set of regulations broadly met everybody's aspirations, I guess you'd say. And so the interesting thing now is that now the regulations have now been proposed or now been published by DENREC, and on the basis of the public comments that we've had in response to those, it seems like nobody's happy. That all sides seem to be quite critical of what DENREC's proposing here.
Yeah, and as your piece points out, it's both sides, the business side that's looking to do the development on these limited number of properties in the coastal zone, and environmental interests, which have been concerned about this kind of renewed development there. Both are taking issue with them. Let's start on the business side. Let's kind of take them one at a time. We'll start on the business side. What fault are they finding with these draft regulations?
Well, some of the strongest criticism has come from Sunoco. Now, Sunoco, of course, owns the Marcus Hook Industrial Complex in Delaware County, Pennsylvania, and also straddles across the Delaware-Pennsylvania line. They own about 45 acres in Delaware. They say that they are actively planning to reactivate that site, which, of course, they've been unable to do since the original Coastal Zone Act was passed in 1971. And one of the things that Sunoco is saying is that, they're highly critical of the regulation that would issue permits, issue a permit to an applicant for a period of only 20 years. And Sunoco is saying that that this is going to put off, this is going to deter any company that might be thinking about spending millions or even billions of dollars in reactivating these sites. Sunoco says, well, there's no way that they're going to do that if their permit is only going to last for 20 years. And Sunoco is also saying so that provision alone, they say, has no basis in either the new law or the original Coastal Zone Act.
On the environmental side, it seems there's a number of different issues that are being raised. One appears to be with the process of developing the regulations themselves. Can you explain that piece of it?
Well, on the environmental side, some of the strongest criticism came from the Delaware Audubon Society. And their argument is that DENREC rushed this process of putting together these regulations. They say that DENREC didn't set up the regulatory advisory committee until about 10 months after the new act became law, and said that the result is a poorly drafted text and that's full of inaccuracies. That is one of the that's one of the criticisms there. I mean, they're also Audubon has also criticised DENREC for holding the these committee meetings during working hours, which they say prevented various interest groups, including themselves, from attending and contributing to this discussion. I mean, and they said that there were a number of public workshops that DENREC held, but they Audubon referred to those as more PR than community engagement.
Another issue was how the regulations handle the issue of sea level rise. Where do some environmental groups find the regulations falling short on that particular issue?
Well, Delaware Ornithological Society was one of those who were critical on the SLR issue, and their specific problem is that the regulations would require applicants to say how their new facilities will be affected by sea level rise over 30 years. Now, what the society says is that there's huge uncertainty with sea level rise. Obviously, Delaware's particularly vulnerable to it. And so what this environmental group says is that coastal zone applicants should be required to project the effect of sea level rise over 50 years, not 30 years, as proposed in the regulations.
The other issue some groups are taking up is regarding the coastal zone environmental goals and indicators. First, can you explain to us a little bit about these environmental goals and indicators and what they mean when it comes to the coastal zone?
Well, there was a fair amount of discussion about these indicators in several of the public comments on the regulations. But the essential point to bear in mind here is that the indicators, these environmental goals and indicators, were never actually defined. There were proposals to include indicators to build those into the current set of regulations that were developed during the 1990s, the late 1990s. But at the time, DENREC said that it didn't have the resources to do that. And now some environmental groups are urging that these indicators should be revived and incorporated into the regulations protections can be put in place for things like endangered bird species.
So is there anything else that the advocates are suggesting the regulations are doing or should be doing with these indicators?
Their real argument, the environmentalist here, is that they say that if the new regulations are finally adopted as written, they would it would essentially make permanent the absence of these environmental indicators. So as it, they would formalize the absence of them, and so they're advocating very strongly that there should be these metrics built into the regulations so that the authorities can see whether these new industrial activities are actually consistent with environmental quality, or in fact whether they're eroding environmental quality, as indicated by things like, you know, bird species and coastal marshes and that sort of thing.
On the other side of things, what is the business community saying about the inclusion or exclusion of these indicators?
Well, there was a submission by Robert Wetzel, as an attorney who represented the Delaware State Chamber of Commerce on the regulatory committee, and he said that the whole idea of environmental indicators were just too vague to really be a legitimate part of the. Of the regulations, and so his argument is that they simply should be removed.
Do we have a sense of where things go from here now? I mean, obviously this is, I guess, supposed to be wrapped up by the fall. I guess what does DENREC do from here?
Well, DENREC, I approached DENREC for comment on this, especially in light of the quite strong criticism from various parties here. And all they would say is that the comments will be, quote, thoroughly vetted, but it's not clear whether there's going to be any more detailed response. And eventually, the regulations have to be adopted by something called the Coastal Zone Industrial Control Board, which was set up back in 1971.
And that's supposed to be done by October, correct?
October 1st is the deadline for finalizing these regulations, yes.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for joining us on The Green this week. Again, his piece on pushback on the draft regulations for the Coastal Zone Conversion Permit Act is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And coming up on The Green, Delaware's Department of Correction has a new commissioner. And Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller sat down with her this week to hear what her priorities are as she takes over. That interview with Claire DeMatteis is next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Claire DeMatteis was sworn in as Delaware Department of Correction Commissioner this week. She's been working with DOC staff for the past 2 years, most recently coordinating reentry initiatives across 6 state agencies. Before that, DeMatteis served as a special assistant at DOC, helping the department implement recommendations made by an independent review of the 2017 deadly prison uprising at Vaughan Correctional Center. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller sat down with DeMatteis this week to talk about her priorities at the Department of Correction and issues facing the department.
Do you have any thoughts on being the first woman commissioner?
I definitely have more hair than all of the past commissioners combined. It's an honor to leave the department as the governor, and as even my sister told me today, my goal isn't to be the first woman leader of the Department of Correction, it's to be the best. And I follow an incredible list of men who have made this department strong, proud, successful, and I'm happy to follow in their footsteps.
We all know that, you know, there's still a shortage of correctional officers, and, you know, I know that you guys are hiring more and stuff like that, but do you guys think that you're going to really get up to, like, a full staff?
The Department of Corrections had over 250 vacancies before in the early 2000s, and by 2009, we were down to 38 vacancies. So we'll get there again. In the past year, we went from 230 vacancies to about 165. And the recruit class that started July 11th has 57 cadets. We'll get there. We have two really strong recruiters and have gotten creative about recruiting and approaching candidates in different states. You know, obviously, former military is are very strong recruits for us. So the team, before I came in, really focused on boosting recruiting efforts, and we'll continue to do that. I have every confidence that we will get our vacancies down to a manageable level, whether that's 30 or 40 or 45, where the department has been in the past, or whether it's lower than that. I am confident we will reduce our vacancies, and the recruits that we have are extremely well qualified. They're going through even more rigorous physical tests than before. And right along with recruiting, you can't just recruit and then lose current officers. So it's a two-part equation. Along with sustaining our high-intensity recruiting efforts, we are really focused on keeping veteran officers.
You didn't come up through the ranks. So do you think that puts you at an advantage or a disadvantage?
I think it's a false choice to say either. I have had the opportunity to work with this team for the past 2 years, but I'm not a sworn law enforcement officer, so I will be surrounded by incredibly professional and experienced law enforcement officials that will balance out perhaps my strengths of executive leadership, critical thinking, problem solving, and delivering results. So I don't think it's an advantage or a disadvantage. I think our strengths together will make this a really strong leadership team.
How much of a priority is inmate health care?
We have to restructure prison-based substance abuse, mental health, and medical care. We are focused as a department on the medical care vendor, and we will be looking at other professionals to run our healthcare. That may be in the next couple months that you'll start hearing more about that, because it does take a process. We are all disturbed by any reports that an inmate's health isn't taken the utmost serious, but there's always two sides of a story. And often, the media only hears part of that story. It's incumbent upon us as Department of Correction leadership to get that full story out, that by and large, you know, 95%+ of the healthcare delivered in our facilities is first-rate healthcare.
Do you think that more should be released when an inmate dies? Like, All you guys do right now is just say there's no foul play suspected. Do you think the public should know more?
Department of Correction is unique in that public safety part of what we do entails some things we can't always report publicly. So we'll take a look at how much information we're releasing, but we will err on the side of privacy when appropriate for an offender and his family. And that privacy extends to medical care often and deaths. If there are opportunities for the department to provide some additional information, we'll take a look at that. But it will always be balanced with the need for and the respect for medical privacy.
Can you just name some of your other top priorities?
Strengthening safety and security. Increasing our focus on recruitment and retention. Modernizing operations and intelligence sharing. There's a lot more we can be doing with technology. We have over 1,000 cameras in our facilities now, and we need to use those cameras proactively and not just as reactive DVRs. So modernizing our intelligence operations, which we're doing, restructuring our medical care and substance abuse treatment for inmates while in prison, continuing to focus on the equipment and the training our probation and parole officers need for what is often very dangerous jobs, and implementing this coordinated comprehensive reentry plan, which is the most comprehensive ever undertaken in our state, to help offenders who reenter our communities, to help them stop returning to crime.
Thanks to new Delaware Department of Correction Commissioner Claire DeMatteis and our Sarah Mueller for their time on The Green this week. There's more to come on The Green in just a few minutes, including a look at the latest edition of a book that highlights the biggest trees in the first state. But first, your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware's Forest Service has published the newest edition of its popular Big Trees of Delaware. It's a comprehensive list of the largest trees currently in the first state, covering an estimated 80 native and non-native species here. Bill Siebold is a forest health specialist with the Delaware Forest Service, and he recently chatted with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about this fifth edition of the book.
Tell us all about Big Trees of Delaware.
The Big Trees of Delaware is it's a program that we keep up continuously, but we publish a booklet about every 5 years listing the top three size-wise of each species with nice color photos of the actual champion. We have measurement system where we try to make it fair so that each tree is measured by a common set of numbers. One is the circumference of the trunk, the height of the tree, and then the crown spread. And we give slight more emphasis on circumference and height. The crown spread is in feet is divided by four. So we kind of de-emphasize crown spread a little bit. But overall, those three numbers are put together in a point system, and the top three point-sized-wise trees are recognized in this booklet.
The new Big Trees of Delaware, the fifth edition, what do you hope the public will use this book for?
We see it as a fun way to introduce the public to trees and the value of trees, and obviously to show them where some of the most exemplary trees are within our state. Some of the best trees are quite a good introduction to, you know, it's a fun way to get out and see the state of Delaware. And it's also a way to recognize some of the custodians of these trees. Obviously, some of these trees go back two or three centuries, but they've been passed down generation to generation in some cases, or to different owners. But we want to also recognize people that are taking good care of their trees, and sometimes in their front yard, or sometimes it's out in the woodlands, but one way or another, they had to have valued these trees over the years.
You know, Delaware is, relatively a small state compared to most others. We're one of the smallest. Mm-hmm. Sure. You know, is Delaware, do we have some large trees in comparison to, let's say, California?
Well, we don't compare to, say, like a redwood tree. Those are famous for being some of the largest trees in the world. But
right.
We actually do have a national co-champion, Osage Orange. It's not truly a native to Delaware, but we grow them quite well here. They like our climate. We have one at Hagley Museum up in near Wilmington. It's a national co-champ. It's very close in size to the other two other trees listed on the National Big Tree Program.
Right, and there's another one pretty big in Greenville, I think. According to my list, it's the Zelkova.
Yeah, that's the Zelkova. That's the largest tree in the state. That's in Greenville, Hillside Road. Right, that's the actual one with the total largest total of points. It has a 325-inch circumference, which is 27 feet.
Wow. And are these trees marked, like, can, you know, if we don't download this book, and we're going to tell people how they can download this book, but if we don't download, if we want to go see these trees, are these trees marked in any specific way?
No. They are privately owned trees for the most part. There's a few that are on state forest land, but we... There may be a few that have a plaque in front of them randomly, but I don't have a program for labeling the trees, no. We have, the only thing we have is a, we're developing it, it's not updated at this point, it's still fourth edition numbers, but there's a virtual tour that you can go to firstmap.delaware.gov and look on there. There's a, if you have a smartphone, you can go out and get the location of the tree as you're walking along.
All right, let's talk about the largest tree. We talked about the largest one in Newcastle County. What's the largest one in Kent County?
Kent County has two trees that are very similar in size. They have a willow oak at Williamsville Road down in Houston. It has 367 points. And a willow oak is like the peach leaf oak, some people call it. It has a narrow leaf. It's actually in the red oak group. And we have the American elm on the green in Dover. That's 367 points as well.
All right. What about the largest in Sussex County?
Sussex County has a sycamore in Greenwood. That's 433 points. So it's really close to our overall champion, which is 448 points. So they're pretty close.
This is all very,
tremendous tree.
All very fascinating. Delaware also has a smallest champion tree. Talk about that.
That is a tree. It's not often called a tree, but it, since it's a single-stemmed woody plant that is gets up to about close to 30 feet tall. It's actually a 29-foot tall Black Haw viburnum. And is a 57-point tree, but since it's the largest we can find of that type of tree, then we put it in the book.
This is all very fascinating. Again, we're talking to Bill Siebold. He's with the Delaware Forest Service. Delaware Forest Service publishing the newest edition of its popular Big Trees of Delaware. It's a comprehensive list of the largest trees covering nearly 80 native and non-native species here in the first state. It features full-color photos, high-quality illustrations of tree leaves. The book is available as a print edition at state forest offices as well as online. Tell people how they can get this book. And there's no charge, by the way.
No. It's available at the Department of Ag's website, agriculture.delaware.gov. It is also available on a our Urban Forestry Program website, Delaware Trees, that's all one word, .com. And it would be available at our Dover Department of Ag Central Office.
Now, when we started this conversation, Bill, you said you put a new book out about every 5 years. Can Kelly Steele, notice a big tree and maybe nominate it as a possible candidate to be included in the next edition?
Yes, absolutely. That's probably how we find, I would say, 80 to 90% of our trees is by the public knowing about trees in their neighborhood and giving me a call or giving one of our state forests a call and nominating a tree. A lot of people take measurements. We'll confirm them before we put it in the book, but a lot of times the measurements are pretty good, and we go ahead and put them in the book that way.
All right. Any final words about Big Trees of Delaware, Bill?
No, we just hope that people can enjoy this and learn something. It's a good introduction to the value of trees, and there's a lot of information about how to take care of your tree in the book, and hope you enjoy it.
Thanks to Delaware Forest Service Forest Health Specialist Bill Siebold and R. Kelly Steele for their time on The Green this week. One final note, Delaware's Big Tree Program is affiliated with the National Register of Big Trees, a list of the largest living specimens of each tree variety found in the continental United States. And stay with us. Art's Playlist is next, where we meet a student writer who was recently recognized nationally for her work. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. and I'm Tom Byrne. A budding local writer recently received national recognition for her work exploring her Chinese-American identity. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt sits down for a conversation with that writer, recent Charter School of Wilmington graduate Sophia Zhao.
This spring, 17-year-old Newark resident Sophia Zhao won a competitive national award for her writing. Recent Charter School of Wilmington graduate and Scholastic Art and Writing Awards gold medal portfolio recipient Sophia Zhao, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me here.
The longest piece in your portfolio is an essay called Meaning of Chinese. You travel to stay with your grandmother in Shanghai, and as you arrive there, you worry about your limited Mandarin language skills. You write, I begin to ponder over whether this would work, being Chinese. I'm going to ask you to read a little bit at the end, but first, your grandmother does something that surprises you. What happened?
So as we arrived there, the first week, she comes up to me and asks, will you help me learn English? And I was very surprised because even when she comes to visit us in America or when we go back to China in previous years, she never talked to us in English. She always speaks to us in Chinese. So I was surprised that she wanted to communicate with us in our own native language.
Can you please read the paragraph starting with, my grandmother is nearly 80?
My grandmother is nearly 80, yet studies English daily. We still can't hold a perfect conversation, but that's okay. I realized it didn't matter where I started from, whether it be knowing zero phrases or a couple hundred, or how late I started. I could still learn gradually, writing a couple sentences per day and reading children's books out loud. It was more important that I cared, that I wanted to jot grandma reminders on what to buy for dinner, that I wanted to decipher museum placards and learn about ancient history, that I wanted to mail friends and family cards brimming with love from top to bottom. That is what it means to be Chinese enough to care.
So you come to this, I guess, discovery of what you think being Chinese enough means. Can you talk a little bit about the feeling when you first got to Shanghai, when you weren't quite sure if you were Chinese enough?
So I guess in my mind, before coming to China, I guess being, quote, Chinese, unquote, enough was being externally Chinese, like practicing the language every day or practicing cultural traditions every day, such as like performance, dance, or anything like that. And when I got to China, I guess I was very insecure about whether I could communicate myself well enough to my relatives and my family friends, especially my language. That's such a pivotal part in connecting with family, and just not being able to write or read well enough. That was very, I guess, dilapidating in what I wanted to show myself to my family there. But like after witnessing my grandmother and how she was trying her best to communicate with us, I understood that, I guess, the practice of using language to understand people is what makes language and culture inevitably so meaningful.
From the writing of yours that I've read, it sounds like identity and connections to other people are, I guess, themes that I see running through it. A lot of your work centers around your grandparents or connections to family and places. How has processing all of that through writing, has it changed sort of your sense of self or who you define yourself to be?
I would say that before I was very defined, but like myself, I would say like what I like to do, like what I want to be. But I think just going back and visiting my family and like reconnecting with my culture, I understood that like identity doesn't always have to come from yourself. It can always come from other people and like your connections and especially family. I think that's very important.
When did you start, you know, writing seriously and what drew you to that medium?
So one of my English teachers in 10th grade introduced a competition and I entered it and I lost. But like it also introduced like a new medium to me because I never took poetry writing seriously. And school is always personal essays, like persuasive research, and I think after a time that got boring and I found poetry very more flexible and more fresh than what I was used to. And I think it was just a way for me to express myself. Creative writing was very liberating for me.
Thanks to Sophia Zhao and our Sophia Schmidt for their time on this week's Arts Playlist. And a quick postscript. Zhao received a $10,000 scholarship as part of her Scholastic Art and Writing Award. She plans to attend Yale University. And we finish up this week's edition of The Green next with Enlighten Me and a look at back-to-school shopping. Stay with us for that here on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. We've just passed mid-July, and a fair amount of summer vacation remains. But while kids continue to enjoy a little downtime, parents need to start thinking about getting the gear their children need for the upcoming school year. Any visit to the local mall will tell you that back-to-school shopping season is here. And each summer, we check in with Delaware Public Media contributor Eileen Dalabrida to learn what the back-to-school retail trends are. Her piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And for this week's Enlighten Me, she joined me to discuss what to expect. So let's start with the outlook for back-to-school sales this year. What are we expecting to see?
It's a very positive year. The National Retail Federation forecast that it is going to be the biggest year ever, with parents spending an average of $696.70, and that's slightly up about $12 from last year. And that tops the previous record that was set in 2017.
And there is a little bit of a difference, right, between spending on, I guess, K through 12 and college age kids, correct?
Yeah. Families with college kids are spending a significant amount more, almost $1,000, because they have dorm rooms and apartments to outfit. And the younger kids don't need coffee makers and refrigerators.
And for now, it appears, I guess, according to what you found, that people are still getting in the car and actually heading to the store to shop, despite the growing online options for shopping, right?
They are. And online has grown slightly, but it has not made serious inroads to this parent-child back-to-school shopping experience. 88% of consumers, that's almost 9 out of 10, say that they're going to the store. They'll do a few things online, but for things like shoes and things that kids like to pick out, they're doing it together.
But the big stores, you know, the Walmarts, the Targets, and such, they do understand they have to kind of have a foot in both of these worlds, online and brick and mortar. What are those type of stores doing to appeal to those shopping online and make that shopping experience a little bit more convenient?
Well, the merchants are being very aggressive and progressive in getting the goods to customers however they wish to buy them. Walmart, if you want to order it online and pick it up in the store, you can do that. If you want to order it online and have it delivered to your car as you pull up, that works too. If you want it sent to your house, that's good. But I think that they would much prefer that you come into the store because you are likely to buy more.
And I guess that's kind of the idea of saying, hey, if you want to order online and pick up, that, you know, someone could say, like, okay, like, I don't need to, like, run around the store looking for pencils and erasers and crayons. I can order all that and have it ready to pick up. But when I go to pick it up, maybe I can go take the kid and find some T-shirts and shoes and things like that. And maybe that kind of helps parents in that regard?
It does. And it's a great time saver, because there are things that are essentially commodities, like binders and pencils and things like that. And then there are the things that you do want to touch, the T-shirts and the jeans and trying on shoes, of course.
And I found it interesting that you note that online shopping has had a bit of an impact on the timing of the back-to-school season. How so?
Well, for the past few years, Amazon Prime has been a major force in the marketplace. And we just finished that in mid-July, and it has really inspired other retailers to get out there and compete with them. A couple of years ago when I started it, there were 6 or 7 retailers who also were offering big deals. This year, there were 250. So there's this bargain bonanza, this big bubble that really entices people to go out there and save some money.
It's amazing that Prime Day has had that kind of impact in such a relatively short period of time.
It is.
So with that in mind, maybe shifting back to school back a little bit into July, perhaps from early August, is it better to get started early on your shopping, or is waiting still an option?
I think it's better to get started early, especially since the prices are good and the inventory is good. Toward the end of the season, things do tend to be a little bit picked over, But if you are feeling pretty confident and there isn't anything that you absolutely positively have to have, you can wait.
I was going to say, it's not like the Christmas holiday shopping season where sometimes that procrastination leads to bigger bargains. There's not likely to be a lot of change in prices between the start of back-to-school shopping and the start of the school year.
The discounts are already very good, very aggressive.
So when we think about back-to-school shopping, you know, as we mentioned, usually you're thinking about the commodity type of things, the crayons, the binders, the pencils. But clothing and accessories, as you noted, are also kind of a big piece of this pie. How big of the pie does that portion make up? And what's the word on back-to-school fashion trends for this year?
Well, clothing and accessories command a little bit more than half, 54% of back-to-school dollars. And wearable technology, like the Apple Watch, is something that is on a lot of shopping lists, although that's categorized in the electronics category. But shoes is always a big deal. And there are some different things that are trendy this year. For young girls, they're gravitating more towards pouches instead of purses, little organized zip-up pouches where they can keep their IDs, maybe a little bit of money, and small toiletries.
And you mentioned the shoes. They're a pretty big deal these days. What should people know about shoe shopping for back to school?
Well, Payless, which had been a force in the marketplace for 63 years, is out of business. And so that's a lot of feet that that other retailers are competing for. And but the three retailers who are best positioned to capture those feet are Walmart, where there is tremendous crossover between Payless shoppers and Walmart shoppers, followed by Target, and then followed by Kohl's, the discounters.
You mentioned earlier the Apple Watch and electronics and gadgets. I recall last year sales in that area, the electronics area, were down a bit. Is that holding true this year, or is that kind of, you know, bouncing back a bit?
It's bouncing back. I think that categories like that typically don't stay down for more than a year or so because people want to replace the technology they have so that the life of that product is not forever. Like school shoes, you need new ones. You outgrow the other one.
Yeah, they only last for so long. The nuts and bolts that remain, the school supplies we mentioned before. How are some of the stores trying to win the dollars in that area, the basics, basically?
Well, they're practically giving them away, Tom. It's the big doorbusters. At Office Depot, you can get three-pronged folders for 33 cents, spiral notebooks for a quarter, a box of 24 Crayola crayons for 75 cents. At Walmart, you can a two-pack of blunt end scissors, that slice has been snipped, to $1.99. It's a big draw. It's a big draw because most kids need them. Teachers also buy them, and it really gets you in the store.
I was going to say, at prices like that, I'm sure many parents think, it's like, wow, that's almost like what we were paying for when I was a kid. So I'm definitely going to go make the most of that deal. Bottom line, there are bargains to be found, and you know, it's worth shopping around to find those bargains, right, to make sure that you're getting the best bang for your buck.
Indeed. And instead of getting on the desktop computer, this year we're seeing a big shift in the way that we are comparison shopping. Now we're doing it on our phones. And it really helps us to do it on the fly. And I think that people are just so good at using their phones. And they're also looking at on their phones for promotions, coupons, discounts, and not spending as much time at the laptop or at the desktop computer.
Thanks to Delaware Public Media contributor Eileen Dalabrida for enlightening us this week. You can read Eileen's piece on back-to-school shopping right now at DelawarePublic.org. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributors Eileen Dalabrida and John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernsink. Thanks for joining us. The Green is going on summer vacation next week, so we'll see you again in 2 weeks on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.